Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, the courtyard of the Gentiles travels to Stockholm, and the Swedish ambassador to the Holy See, Ulla Gudmundsson, shares with us her impressions. The Hungarian Academy in Rome hosts a conference focusing on pagans and Christians in antique Rome. And translating Deus Caritas Est into Latin, our popular Latin lover tells all. About to bring you an interview with the Swedish ambassador to the Holy See, Ulla Gudmundsson. She shares with Charlotte Smeds some impressions of the courtyard of the Gentiles project, which travelled to Sweden from the 13th to the 14th of September. An encounter which had as a theme a world with or without God. Stay tuned.
I would say that we had two extremely oxygen-rich conversations, one at the Royal Academy of Sciences and one at Fryshus, at this extraordinary place for young people, where young people's energy and passion is channeled into creative endeavors. And these conversations were very different. One was philosophical, scientific, theological, dealing with things like the relationship between science and faith, and the other was very practical. What does belief or non-belief mean in our ordinary lives, for our relations with other people, and for our relationship with the world? And I think these were not, as so many discussions are, train compartment discussions where people actually think more or less alike. It was, in fact, an extremely wide spectrum of views, from the secular humanist, non-believing scientists, to representatives of the Swedish church, to a young Muslim, to a young Christian. It was a really wide spectrum of views, and one conclusion is, of course, that it's perfectly possible to have meaningful, respectful conversations between people with these different standpoints without arriving at the false consensus and without it degenerating into a boxing match. And that's extremely encouraging.
Charlotte Smeds then asked the ambassador about the growing indifference to faith in our secular society today, an issue the president of the Pontifical Council for Culture, Gianfranco Ravasi, expressed concern about while in Sweden.
I would say that attitude is more common in Sweden among ordinary Swedes than a militant atheism. In these panels, we had at least three persons who had gone from a position of non-believing to a position of believing. But we had also one person, Per Wirtén, a Swedish writer and journalist, who grew up in one of the Swedish three churches and who has since then lost his faith. And I think the cardinal quoted on his Twitter Per-Olof Enquist, a very well-known Swedish writer, who went through this experience, as have other Swedish writers who also have described it, of faith simply drifting away. I think this is a very common attitude among Swedes. And many people, of course, feel perfectly comfortable with it, and not necessarily hostile towards religion. That was certainly the case of Per Wirtén, whom we had in our conversation. One of the questions raised at the end was, would the world be better or worse without religion? And he came down very strongly on the side of the world being worse without religion, in spite of not being a believer.
Charlotte Smeds then asked the ambassador how religion can play into a society as secular as the Swedish one.
Sweden is a very modernist, a very secular state that shows up in, for instance, in World Value Survey, you know, the international survey of values that's been going on for quite some time. And that applies to all the Nordic countries. I think, of course, that there are a lot of good things that may have something to do with that. It's the, for instance, the position of women, the strong scientific tradition, the possibility to think freely. And these are very precious things that we wouldn't want to lose. But I think that doesn't mean that religion does not have a place and that the religion has something to offer people in terms of meaning and coherence in their lives. I think it was a great pleasure having Cardinal Ravasi here. He impressed everybody, I think, particularly with his familiarity of Swedish literature, of our classical authors. But I think Sweden is a more complex place than simply the land of atheists. And I think through these many meetings, you know, I think we established a better rapport between, you know, a representative of an open, a Catholic church that wants dialogue with the world, and a Swedish society which is actually much more complex, both our non-believers and our believers. In fact, what these conversations showed, I think, is that this is not black and white. You can believe in many different ways, and you can be a non-believer in many different ways. And there's not necessary consensus within each camp, if you would call it that.
And you were listening there to the Swedish ambassador to the Holy See, Ola Gudmundsson, speaking to Charlotte Smeds of our Scandinavian programme. Our thanks go to both of them. And now changing the subject, we join Professor of Medieval Studies at the Central European University in Hungary's capital, Budapest. Her name is Marianne Shaggy, and she speaks to us about a two-day conference focusing on pagans and Christians in late antique Rome, which takes place from the 20th to the 21st of September. It's hosted by the Hungarian Academy of Rome, and this conference has brought together historians from across the world to discuss issues such as religion and the emperor, religion and the urban prefecture. Rome being a natural choice for the venue with its wealth of archaeological evidence, perfect place to discuss new material and textual evidence for the survival of paganism and the expansion of Christianity. As Professor Shaggy tells me, a reading of the 4th and 5th century Roman Empire in terms of the interaction between pagans and Christians has provided the leading paradigm for historical and theological discourse from late antiquity until the middle of the 20th century, when Andreas Alfaldi presented a Christian Constantine in conflict with a pagan Rome. But why don't you stay tuned and listen to what Professor Marianne Shaggy has to say. Professor Shaggy, my first question is, can one speak of pagans and Christians in late antique Rome?
That's the big question. And the real question is whether we can talk about pagans and Christians, or who are the pagans and who are the Christians? How do these people define themselves? How do they identify themselves? What makes a pagan pagan? Whether it's religion or culture or tradition or even a kind of reaction against the new Christian establishment. And what would or how would Christians define themselves, identify themselves? What we would like to study is, and also launch, this is the new paradigm in our field, because in the 1930s, a Hungarian scholar, András Alföldi, produced a very powerful thesis about the conflict between paganism and Christianity in the 4th century, saying that only the Emperor Constantine was Christian when he came to Rome, and he had to struggle with all sorts of wayward and backward pagans who didn't see the importance of renewal in the sign of the cross. That's obviously a very extreme view. I mean, Alföldi never talked about the church, for example, whether Constantine had any contact with the church. On the other hand, he's right, because we have very little evidence about Constantine being in touch with the Bishop of Rome at that time. So the evidence what we have, and that's also a very scarce evidence, is that big basilicas are being built above the tombs of the martyrs. And that's why later on Damasus becomes so interesting, because his endeavor looks like a kind of counter-reaction or an appropriation of the martyrs to the church rather than to the emperor. The emperor appears as a powerful private patron of Christianity. But how does the church or the Christian community react? And Offerdy was right in kind of pointing out that we have very little evidence about all that. That led him to this kind of portrayal of Constantine, the lonely or the lonesome Christian hero riding into Rome as a new Moses, founding a new imperial setup in the Urbs, in the great metropolis that was Rome at that time. But this view had been challenged ever since. And in the 60s, 70s, and especially in the 90s, a new model of accommodation, assimilation, enculturation came to being. And now, recently, last year, Professor Alan Cameron of Columbia University published a very important book on the last pagans of Rome, saying that all the important figures and important issues that had been described as the swan song of paganism in 4th century Rome are basically not more than historiographical creations, that these are constructions made by historians to grasp the evidence or to deal with the evidence. But we cannot really describe the last pagans no more as we could describe the, let's say, the last communists of Russia, for example, or of Hungary.
So if I understand correctly, Rome, with its wealth of archaeological evidence, is a natural venue for this conference, in which you explore new material and textual evidence for the survival of paganism and the expansion of Christianity.
We will discuss the memories of the gods and the transformation of the gods. We will talk about the cult places, the pagan cult places in 4th century Rome. I think this is one of the hottest issues, whether the pagan sanctuaries continue to function or not. We have a lot of imperial edicts, almost every year that the pagan sacrifices should stop. But nobody buys it anymore. This means that these sacrifices went on. It's a little bit like the drug policy. The more edicts we have against drug abuse, it's clearly evidence that drugs are still being used by people. Another important issue will be magic. What is considered magic? And historians now suspect that everything is magic, what you don't like.
What was called pagan cult becomes magic.
Yes, or could become pagan cult if you don't like it. If you can integrate it into your own thought world, then you are not branding it as magic.
I see there'll be a talk focusing on the Roman calendar. Tell me a little bit about it.
The keynote speaker, Michelle Zaltzman, is an expert of the Roman calendar. She published a very important book 20 years ago about the Codex Calendar of 354, which is a wonderful evidence on the one hand on the continuity of the classical imagery and classical representation of the months and the gods. On the other hand, the enculturation of this classical heritage into Christian culture, because the owner of this calendar, interestingly, was a Christian aristocrat. And every single page of this calendar represents pagan sacrifices, pagan feasts, pagan holidays. And Michelle Zaltzman very rightly pointed out that it's not the owner of the calendar that was pagan, but time was pagan still in 4th century Rome, because there were no Christian holidays. The only Christian holiday that existed was Easter, and nothing really else. So they could not represent, even if you wanted to represent something really nice, let's say in June, you could not, because there was no tradition whatsoever in representing, let's say, the feast of St. Peter and Paul.
Another issue to be discussed is religion and the urban prefect. To what extent did he promote or prohibit Christianity? I presume that he was normally a non-Christian, but that he wouldn't necessarily be hostile to Christianity, no?
Yes, they make the decision, and interestingly, one of the guys whom classical historiography used to called the last pagan, Symmachus, was on very good terms with the Bishop of Rome. He always promoted Christian causes, but he also reconstructed and restored important pagan monuments. And that's another big issue, the cultural heritage movement, because paganism is also a huge classical heritage, a huge cultural heritage. What do Christians do with this heritage? Do they collect it? Do they destroy it? The earlier view was that they would destroy everything, and it's completely untrue. The Christians established the first big collections of classical statues, and they really looked at the statues of gods as artwork. This is the beginning of our own appreciation of art.
Looking at the leaflet describing the conference, I see that another issue to be discussed is poetry and propaganda. An interesting combination, no?
This is what I also point out when I deal with Pope Damasus, that when he writes about the martyrs, he writes elogia or praises of the martyrs. This is sheer propaganda, because he says that I, Damasus, praise the martyr and I approach the martyr to intervene on my behalf and on the behalf of my church in heaven. And I think that's an important propagandistic move to promote his own faction and to appropriate the martyrs for his own faction. And as I said, there had been zillions of Christian factions in 4th century Rome. So poetry had always been seen as an important tool of propaganda, and it hasn't really changed in the 4th century.
And you were listening there to Professor of Medieval Studies at the Central European University in Hungary's capital, Budapest, Marian Shaggy, speaking to us about a two-day conference focusing on pagans and Christians in late antique Rome, taking place from the 20th to the 21st of September, and hosted by the Hungarian Academy of Rome. Finally, our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Reginald Foster, tells us how he translated Pope Benedict's first encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, into Latin. You translated it from what language? Italian.
Well, it's Italian, but you can see right away what the Italian wasn't the original. I wanted to do it from German. The original was German, and you could see it right away, but they said, no, everyone's translating from Italian. So we're stuck with the Italian, but you could see the Italians don't like the Italian. Mm. You see? And so anyway, we did it, and it's very short, 46.
So what's it called in Latin?
Deus Caritas Est, God is love, from St. John's first letter.
So why is charity translated into love? Caritas is in Italian.
Charity, I know.
Charity.
Well, that's another story. He spends about 40 pages on the difference between eros, you know, like passionate love, and agape, spiritual love, and charity, and dilectio. Goes through all the words. Well, anyway.
Yes, but charity is
one thing.
Is one thing, and love is another. In English, the title is God is Love.
Yes, I know. The Vulgate. The Vulgate has caritas.
Caritas. So it's wrong to translate it as God is charity.
Yeah, it doesn't sound right. Hmm. Yeah, it doesn't sound right at all. But, that's the whole thing about love and love this and all that.
So
anyway.
What did you find hardest? Can I ask you what you found hardest to translate?
Well, you find hardest is this modern, I would say the modern, I don't have nothing against what is modern, but it's this jargon that you have around, got it? Like love. Love turns someone into a we, you know. Love, you know, a love of our friend turns our friend into a, not into us, but into a certain we. Well, how are you supposed to say all this stuff? You know how people are talking today. That love would make one person out of two. And so love of a friend, for me, turns us into a certain we. Oh! And you go on and on like this where you can't, it's so impossible to translate some of this stuff. They just never thought that way. The Romans just never thought that way. You know? or how I'm going to miss a little of my own ego, you know. Well, you have to say in Latin, my own person or something like that.
Ego is a Latin word.
Yes, I know, but there's no way to say it. If you say mei, well, that's a piece of me. But to say I'm losing a piece of me is one thing, and I'm losing a piece of my ego is another thing.
It's difficult because they're all concepts.
Yes, and I'm going to say modern. I don't even like the word modern. But
you say it's modern jargon, no?
Yes, I mean, modern talk. Jargon. Everyone's doing this. Theologians do this, you know, little pamphlets, and everyone's talking this way, and it's preachers. It's horrible. And I told the students the other day, we were reading St. Augustine. They were almost even in tears of St. Augustine. It's so beautiful. I said, well, you have nothing to say. Just translate St. Augustine on the pulpit and sit down and shut up.
Modern jargon. How would you say that in Latin, modern jargon?
Yeah.
Modern jargon is horrible.
Yeah.
Well, horrible is
loquela,
easy.
Loquela, locutio. Ah, yeah, recensior locutio. Bene, eso, terribilis, vel horribilis, vel fugienda est.
But yet,
it's like in the newspapers, you know, everyone just talking around and, you know, gee, oh, it's terrible.
Yet you say, you told me on another occasion that Pope Benedict the 16th is extremely aware of the Latin language.
Oh, yeah. And, he's used it all his life.
And he's also notoriously fond of people like St. Augustine and St. Bonaventure.
Yes.
And so he has a soft spot, in a sense, for Latin.
There's no question about it.
For Latin. So how do you say Pope Benedict has a soft spot for Latin?
Yeah. No. De lingua latina tenere sentit. That would be nice. De lingua latina tenere sentit. He feels tenderly about the Latin language. That sounds nice. Tenere sentit. Well,
he changed it too, didn't he?
Whoa, yes.
Because you had...
We did it in October, November, but since October we were changing some...
What were you changing?
I mean, there are words that aren't right and the phrases weren't right. And.
So how'd you say fine-tuning Pope Benedict's Latin?
Oh, yeah, well, we're just going to say, yeah.
Well, it's not really his Latin. You're fine-tuning his encyclical.
What do you say, perficere?
His encyclical. How do you say encyclical?
Yeah, literas encyclicas. Tornare, to polish. Perpolire, to polish off. There is a nice one.
The word encyclical is encyclica. What did it mean to Romans, the word encyclical?
Well, it didn't mean anything. This is a church term. Actually, it's a Greek, of course. It's Greek encyclo, which means in the circuit. So a letter that the emperors had encyclicals too. The letters that the emperors sent in a circuit throughout the empire was an encyclica, that's all.
So it came from the Greek?
Oh, yeah, encyclo, in the circle.
There were a few Greek words in this encyclical, no, like agape.
Yes, and a few, I forget, koinonia.
How do these words
translate? They're all in the Bible, you see, and so we had to take kind of what the Vulgate gave us.
You use the word agape?
Oh yeah, I mean, what are you going to say? It's spiritual, or let's say, noble love.
And what's the other word you mentioned?
Diakonia, service. And koinonia was the communion, the community, koinonia. Those are all Greek words in the church, you see.
But you still use those words in Greek. You don't translate them into Latin.
No, I would do. I would put it. I would, you know.
So what's koinonia?
I would say, for example, like communitas or communio. And I'd put a comma and say, in Greek, koinonia, to respect the original text. But I would tell the people in Latin, you have to say this.
And when it comes to agape?
Well, then it has to be caritas. And eros, of course, has to be amor. See?
It's a difficult word, eros, because it's taken on different connotations
in
modern languages.
Well, he has a long section on that. And he said, if you just leave eros, amor, the way it is, it's not going to do anything. Because he said, eros without charity is nothing. It's just passionate animal love. He says this. You got the idea. But that's the whole thing is all around and around. I went, we almost went crazy with the thing.
Was there any Roman who wrote about love that way?
Well, not exactly that.
Not obviously history, you know, such as a theological.
Yeah, no, but
sort of
Ovid, ooh, heaven's sake, Ars Amatorium, art, and Amores, he wrote about love stories. He had all kinds of love stories.
Who's this?
Ovid, Ovidius. One of the most famous men in the world for love poetry.
But they were very immaterial, the Romans, when they spoke about love, weren't they?
Immaterial. Well, yeah, I mean, they didn't. Well, although they had noble sentiments. We were reading Seneca in class. You just can't believe it. And that's why I said during the Middle Ages, a lot of people thought that Seneca had been inspired by Christians. Because he has such noble things. Virtue is this, and without an adversary, virtue languishes. And God, and ooh, he has a whole thing about divine providence. He has a whole dialogue on divine providence. You can't believe it. Where God is talking to people, I'm punishing you or giving you hard things to do to make you strong and mature and all that. That's all in Seneca. Mm. And if you change the title and say St. Thomas Aquinas, ooh, they would accept it right away. Oh, the Romans had much more than we thought. People think they were stupid old, you know, like, you know, Hollywood orgy things. Well, they were not stupid orgy things.
So how does Seneca compare with the way St. Thomas Aquinas wrote Latin?
Oh, well, it's a different thing. Thomas Aquinas is school stuff, you know, kind of, you know, we would call it kind of like the spaghetti side. I mean, he was very functional. No, in school he talked that way and wrote that way just as it came out, but it would be, you know, just kind of without any kind of an idea of beauty and stuff, where Seneca has beautiful sentences, really, where he thinks of the effectiveness of Latin. Thomas was a different man and was doing something different.
Mm, St. Augustine, every day.
Oh, yeah. Although a lot of people say, and I agree, if people had kept St. Thomas, like, you know, Latin would be living today because it's very easy and functional, you see. All the classicists said, no, it's so corrupt and deteriorated and everything else. And so they threw it out in the Renaissance and put Cicero in, and Latin died. Yeah, it's unfortunate. I like St. Thomas. You have to be careful because he uses the Latin language perfectly. Mm, yeah,
it's more accessible to us.
Oh, yeah, and we were reading the other day, all the students were wild. We were reading St. Bonaventure. The sermons of St. Bonaventure at Mass, and a sermon that he gave to the nuns up in Assisi. Oh, it was so beautiful and neat and sweet. And they said, this is Frater Bonaventura's sermon to the sisters of St. Clara. So that kind of Latin is very, very excellent.
And warm thanks there to our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, who's currently teaching Latin in the United States, but was, for many years and under many popes, papal Latinist. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at the same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.radiovaticana.va. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.
If you have an Android smartphone, visit our website and download Vatican Radio's first app. It's free. Go to www.radiovaticana.va and click on the icon in the upper right-hand corner. The version for iPhone and iPad is coming soon.